Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that cuts through the noise and delivers you the essential insights from the world shaping our federal government. I'm Corey Smith.
And I'm Morgan Johnson. It's great to be here. My role is really to help you connect the dots between these critical updates and truly understand their broader implications, maybe some hidden depths too.
Absolutely. Today, we're embarking on a really crucial deep dive. The title is The Federal News Network Late Edition for Tuesday, August 26th, 2025. And we've got a pretty substantial stack of incredibly important federal updates to unpack.
Yeah, it's quite a list today.
It really is. We'll be covering, well, everything from sweeping reforms in federal acquisition, the rapid integration of AI that's huge, to some pressing cybersecurity concerns that, frankly, demand our attention.
And significant shifts in workforce policy, too, affecting thousands of federal employees. We can't forget that.
Exactly. Plus, a major environmental ruling that could, you know, redefine climate regulation for years to come. And even a remarkable legal clash involving the judiciary itself.
A real constitutional question there.
Right. So our mission, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge, those key insights from all this material, offering you a shortcut to being truly well-informed about the issues shaping our federal government right now.
Exactly. And we're not just going to skim the surface, are we? We'll be connecting the dots across these diverse topics, exploring not just what's happening, but digging into why it matters, what the broader implications are for agencies, sure, but also for federal employees. And crucially, for you, the public.
Seeing those threads that connect everything.
Precisely. It's about seeing the intricate threads that connect these seemingly separate developments and trying to anticipate their impact down the line.
Okay, let's unpack this first incredibly dynamic area. The revolutionary overhaul of federal acquisition. Our sources are highlighting a lot of excitement, actually, particularly around the latest package of federal acquisition regulation, you know, the FIR changes. They dropped on August 14th.
Right, that latest package.
And Emily Murphy from George Mason University, she's a widely respected voice in this space. She was quoted saying she was really excited to read it, and it's going to be a lot of fun to see how it ends up being implemented.
That's pretty strong enthusiasm for regulatory updates, wouldn't you say? That suggests these aren't just minor tweaks.
Exactly. It speaks volumes, right? About the significant philosophical shift, maybe, underpinning these changes.
It absolutely does. The core identity of these latest FAR revisions, and this administration has been pretty consistent on this, it's a relentless drive towards simplification and commercialization.
Those two words keep coming up.
They do. These aren't just minor adjustments. They represent a concerted strategic effort to make federal procurement faster, more efficient, and frankly, far more accessible, aligning it more closely with how the commercial world actually operates.
So less red tape, more business-like.
That's the idea. The deeper insight here, maybe, is that this isn't just an administrative update. It's a strategic reorientation. They're aiming to fundamentally reshape the government's entire purchasing landscape. It's a big picture move.
Okay, so one of the real game changers in this package, according to Emily Murphy, it involves FAR Part 8. That deals with required sources of supplies and services.
Right, the hierarchy of sources.
Exactly. And specifically, it's this unprecedented prioritization of best-in-class, or BIC, contracts. Contracting officers, the FEOs, they're now mandated to look first at government-wide BIC contracts, right after Ability One and Federal Prison Industries, of course.
That's a fundamental shift in the process, yeah.
So what does this really mean on the ground? For the competitive landscape, for
right.
Businesses trying to work with the government, especially if they're not currently on one of those BIC contracts.
Oh, it's monumental. You called it a game changer, and that's spot on. For companies not already on a government-wide BIC contract, you're now at a significant, almost immediate competitive disadvantage. It's just reality.
So the door gets harder to open.
Pretty much. Cordos aren't just encouraged anymore to consider BICs. They have to look there first, period. And if a CO decides, for whatever reason, to choose a non-BIC option, well, now they have to go through this rigorous process. They need a determination and findings, a DNF.
Which sounds like more paperwork, not less.
Exactly. And it has to be approved way up the chain by the head of contracting activity, the HCA, or even a senior procurement executive. This adds a substantial bureaucratic hurdle that just, well, wasn't there before.
So it creates a really strong incentive to just stick with the BICs.
A powerful incentive, yeah. For agencies to gravitate towards those established BIC solutions. Now, the deeper insight here may be a bit counterintuitive. While this aims to streamline procurement, make it faster, it could inadvertently stifle innovation. By heavily favoring the established players, the ones already on the BICs, it might make it harder for cutting edge, maybe smaller businesses, the ones with truly novel solutions, to break into federal contracting if they aren't already inside that BIC framework.
So it could create a closed loop almost.
It creates a preferred path, absolutely. And the justification required to deviate from that path, it's now much more involved, much more time consuming. It's a real barrier.
That makes a lot of sense, especially that point about potential barriers for new innovators. Okay, so with this new mandate, it really seems like the General Services Administration, GSA, and the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, they have a huge task ahead.
Oh, definitely.
Making these BIC solutions explicitly clear, easy for COs to find, easy to use. And our sources connect this directly to GSA's, well, frankly, ambitious request for information. They want a massive procurement ecosystem.
Right, the one-stop shop idea.
Exactly. Designed to be that one-stop shop for all GSA acquisition-related activities, potentially serving up to, what, 250,000 users? How big of an undertaking is this proposed system, really?
It's enormous. A cradle-to-grave approach, as Emily Murphy put it. I mean, just try to imagine a single integrated digital platform, consolidating all the information, all the acquisition vehicles, schedules, GIPACs, travel contracts, fleet management.
And everything GSA touches on acquisition.
Essentially, yes. Everything GSA handles on the federal acquisition side. If, and it's a big if it's successfully implemented, it would be absolutely transformative. It would provide the necessary digital backbone, you know, the infrastructure, to support these significant new policy changes, making it much easier for COs to navigate this new BIC-first landscape.
So it's more than just a website upgrade.
Oh, much more. It's about fundamentally reimagining how federal acquisition is digitally managed, how it's accessed across the board. It affects hundreds of thousands of users and, well, trillions of dollars in contracts eventually. It's massive.
And still on Part 8, the FAR now, for the very first time, explicitly mentions shared services. It encourages COs to consider them before making an award. That seems subtle, but I imagine it's an important signal in this ongoing push for efficiency.
It is. Another clear signal towards efficiency, towards consolidation, leveraging existing government resources. But there's another really fascinating shift, again, within Part 8 that caught my eye. It's the relocation of ordering procedures for schedules.
Okay, where do they go?
They've been moved out of FAR Part 38 and into the General Services Acquisition Manual, the GAM. Now, what's fascinating here is how this change streamlines single award blanket purchase agreements, BPAs, and it significantly reduces the need for independent evaluations.
So simplifying things for GSA.
For GSA, yes.
Yeah.
But more importantly, it grants GSA more independence from the RR Council for future changes to the schedules program itself.
Ah, so they can move faster.
Exactly. This allows GSA to adapt its offerings more quickly, more flexibly, without going through the sometimes cumbersome, sometimes very lengthy RFR Council process. The deeper implication, GSA gains increased autonomy. That could lead to more agile responses to market changes, definitely, but maybe also potentially less oversight from the broader federal acquisition community, a trade-off.
Interesting. Okay, let's move on to FR Part 12. We're seeing a continued, very strong emphasis on commercial acquisition here. And the most striking change, the one that feels really impactful, it's the new $7.5 million threshold for simplified acquisition procedures.
Yeah, that number jumps out.
It really does. That's a massive leap from the previous $250,000 limit. What does that signify for the everyday work of a contracting officer and maybe for the contractors themselves?
This is truly profound. I don't think that's an overstatement. Yeah. This massive increase in the simplified acquisition threshold, it's going to dramatically reduce the administrative burden on COs.
Yeah.
It frees up a significant amount of their time, their energy, that was previously just consumed by lower dollar yet often still complex procurements.
So they can focus on bigger things.
Hopefully. And for contractors, especially maybe original equipment manufacturers, OEMs, this simplification, it could be a huge incentive to engage more directly with the government as prime contractors. Because the red tape for these, you know, mid-range contracts is now drastically reduced.
How much reduced?
The source notes that this change alone eliminated a third of the clauses previously associated with Part 12. That's a substantial reduction in compliance complexity. Think about that.
Wow, a third. That's significant.
It is. Now, the deeper insight here. While this reduces bureaucracy, which is good, it also fundamentally shifts the risk calculus, right? COs will need, frankly, unprecedented training and support to make informed choices on much larger contracts now without those prior layers of review.
So it opens the door for efficiency, but maybe also for mistakes.
Potentially. It opens avenues for efficiency, yes, but if not managed properly, also for error. It puts more on the CEO's shoulders.
And quite surprisingly, the sources note that construction projects are now included in the $7.5 million simplified procurement category. That feels, well, counterintuitive, given how unique construction projects often are, the complex regs involve.
It definitely presents a significant challenge, and it's something many in the industry are watching very, very closely. The construction industry, you know, they've traditionally viewed each project as distinct, unique site conditions, material needs, specialized labor. It's inherently difficult to commercialize in the same way you might buy software or, you know, office supplies.
Even with the Brooks Act still applying.
Right.
Even with the BRICS Act still applying, which, just for context, ensures qualifications-based selection for architect and engineering services, not just lowest price, applying a simplified commercial acquisition lens to construction purchases up to $7.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's going to require a significant cultural shift and procedural shift
yeah.
for both government and industry.
So the big question is how?
Exactly. What's fascinating here is how this will actually be carried out for these quote-unquote smaller purchases mm-hmm. in an industry that rarely considers a project small once it hits the multi-million dollar mark.
Mm-hmm.
The practical implementation details, those are going to be absolutely key.
Okay, so with all these rapid changes, the huge increase in simplified acquisition, the BIC prioritization, this drive for speed, what does this all mean for the contracting officers, the ones trying to balance this new push for innovation and efficiency with those long-standing critical principles of fairness and equality in bids? How do they navigate this new, sometimes maybe contradictory, terrain?
That is the critical question, isn't it? And it really highlights the ongoing tension. These changes make thorough, well-documented market research more critical than ever before. Absolutely essential.
So more homework for the CIOs.
More homework. And different kinds of homework.
Yeah.
CIOs will need to leverage every tool they have, sources sought notices, industry days, structured conversations with vendors, really, to educate themselves on the available solutions, to understand the art of the possible beyond just the familiar options they might have used before.
And Emily Murphy raised another important point.
She did. A really important question about the fate of the Small Business Innovation Research Program, SBIR. If these commercialized SBIR solutions aren't on BIC contracts, well, it could inadvertently erode their preferred status.
Undercutting small business innovation.
Potentially, yes. Undercutting a vital pathway for small business innovation within the federal landscape. It truly is, as she put it, like a jigsaw puzzle.
Where we're just getting pieces.
Exactly. Where we're getting just 4 or 5 pieces at a time and trying to figure out what the picture is going to be. CAECOs are effectively building that picture as they go. The overarching insight. While speed and simplicity are the goals, the complexity of ensuring equity, of mitigating unforeseen risks, that hasn't diminished, it's just shifted.
That's a vivid analogy from Emily Murphy. A jigsaw puzzle where the picture isn't clear yet. It certainly sounds like an ongoing, evolving process. Constant adaptation required.
Now let's pivot slightly from the broader federal level down to the Army. They're also actively revamping their own acquisition policy. Specifically, they're paring back mandatory peer reviews for contracts.
Mm.
What drove this particular change for the Army? What does it signal about their approach?
This change was driven by, well, a frank recognition, a recognition that peer reviews, while maybe initially intended for learning, for sharing best practices, they had become stovepiped, that's the word used, and they were causing significant unnecessary delays in an environment that absolutely demands agility.
How significant were the delays? Danielle Moyer, she's the executive director of Army Contracting Command, she highlighted that in the worst-case scenarios, these reviews could add up to 35 additional weeks to contract awards.
35 weeks? That's nearly 9 months.
9 months. A huge amount of time in a defense environment where speed to capability is absolutely paramount. The original intent, you know, was collaborative learning, but it had somehow morphed into this process of second-guessing. Rather than actually improving the contracting process, it was just slowing things down without necessarily adding commensurate value.
And Kimberly Buehler, she's the acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Procurement, she clearly stated the goal, less process and more thoughtful decision-making, advocating for greater discretion for senior contracting officials. What does that look like in practice? What are the potential risks, the benefits?
Absolutely. The Army wants to empower its senior contracting officials. Let them determine when and what types of reviews are truly beneficial instead of having this blanket mandate for every contract above a certain dollar threshold.
So more judgment calls.
More judgment calls. Taking calculated risks. applying expertise where it's most needed, and fostering earlier, more constructive conversations with industry rather than that last-minute, often kind of adversarial scrutiny.
What about the risks, like more protests?
They're aware of that risk. To mitigate potential downsides, like an increase in bid protests, the Army's emphasizing stronger, more collaborative relationships with industry, encouraging direct communication with vendors, trying to resolve issues before they escalate into formal protests. A strategy that, she notes, has actually already seen protest numbers go down.
So the benefit is speed, responsiveness.
Right. The benefit is speed and responsiveness. The risk is potentially less external oversight, which places a greater burden of judgment squarely on individual contracting officers. It requires trust in their expertise.
Now, Major General Douglas Lowry, commanding general of Army Contracting Command, he offered a broader perspective, suggesting that simply fixing the contracting process itself isn't enough. He believes we need to rethink requirements definition, leverage commercial solutions more. Can you elaborate on that broader vision?
That's right. Lowry argues, pretty persuasively, I think, that the real bottleneck often lies way upstream, in defining the requirements themselves, not just in the contracting phase later on.
So the problem starts earlier.
Much earlier, potentially. He points out that in today's rapidly evolving tech landscape, striving for a perfect requirement or a perfect process, well, it means you'll always be late to the game, always behind the curve.
So what's the alternative?
He advocates for commercializing more solutions, using off-the-shelf stuff when it makes sense. Like his example was using off-the-shelf dozers from Caterpillar instead of demanding custom-designed, military-specified equipment for absolutely everything.
If commercial works, use commercial.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's about shifting the mindset, moving away from bespoke, custom military solutions for everything toward agile, commercially available options when they're appropriate, to inject speed across the entire acquisition bureaucracy, not just tinkering within the contracting phase.
And this ties into broader DoD changes.
It does. It ties directly into the DoD's broader efforts to dismantle that decades-old Joint Capabilities Integration and Development System, you know, JCIDs. The process for setting requirements.
It's a really slow one.
The notoriously slow, paper-heavy process that could take over 800 days just to bless a single requirement document. The new approach focuses on time-bounded pathways, aligning joint problems with joint money, and giving validation authority back to the individual services.
So less top-down control from the joint staff.
Less micromanagement, yes. The Joint Requirements Oversight Council, the JROC, will focus more on identifying the big, key operational problems, rather than getting bogged down in every single detail. It's a fundamental shift from a rigid, sequential process to something hopefully more flexible, more outcome-oriented, aimed at integrating industry innovations much, much faster.
Okay, let's shift gears now. Moving into the digital frontier, starting with artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, we've heard that the Federal Chief Information Officers, the CIO Council, has asked FedRAMP to prioritize AI cloud services for security certification.
That's a significant development.
It is. For listeners who might be familiar but maybe need a quick refresher, what exactly is FedRAMP and why is this prioritization such a critical step, especially given how fast AI is being adopted everywhere?
Absolutely. So FedRAMP, that's the Federal Risk and Authorization Management Program. It's essentially the federal government's standardized approach to security for assessment, authorization, continuous monitoring, specifically for cloud products and services.
Setting the security bar for the cloud.
Exactly. Its whole purpose is to ensure that any cloud service used by federal agencies meets really stringent security requirements. Protecting sensitive government data is job number one. So, prioritizing AI cloud services for FedRAMP certification is indeed a critical step.
Why now?
Because it ensures that as federal agencies rapidly adopt AI tools, and they are adopting them rapidly, they're doing so with the assurance that these services meet robust security standards. They're not just jumping in without checking the safety net.
And the CIO Council set specific criteria for this.
They did. 5 new criteria for this prioritization. It includes things like demonstrating demand from at least 5 CFO Act agencies. Those are the big ones, DOD, VA, HHS, places like that.
So real agency need.
Real agency need. Plus offering enterprise-grade features, think single sign-on, role-based access, that kind of thing. Guaranteeing data separation and protection, which is huge for AI, being available in the GSA multiple award schedule already. And crucially, meeting what they call FedRAMP 20X authorization within 2 months of being accepted for prioritization.
20X, what does that mean?
20X refers to an expedited authorization process. It's designed to accelerate the security review for these high-demand critical technologies like AI, speeding up the usually lengthy FedRAMP process.
But are any AI tools meeting this high bar yet?
Well, that's the interesting part. It's important to note that currently no AI cloud services actually meet all five of these new, pretty rigorous criteria, which just highlights the high bar they're setting right out of the gate.
That is a very high bar. Makes sense given the sensitivity of federal data, though. Thomas Shedd, he's the Director of Technology Transformation Services at GSA, called this a transformative moment. And Josh Gruenbaum, the Federal Acquisition Service Commissioner, emphasized it as a critical step for deploying trusted AI.
Yeah, their statements really underscore the administration's deep commitment to the president's AI action plan and the imperative to rapidly integrate AI, but do it responsibly.
So are any AI providers already in the pipeline?
Well, GSA has already awarded scheduled contracts to three leading commercial AI providers. You've got Google's Gemini, OpenAI's ChatGPT, and Anthropic's Claude. But as of now, only Gemini currently has full FedRAMP authorization, and that's specifically through its workstation offering.
Just one so far.
Just one fully authorized. Now, Peter Waterman, he's the director of FedRAMP, he offers a key insight here. He views existing federal information laws as perfectly applicable to AI. He says, you know, treat AI information flows the same as any other service.
So no special magic rules for AI.
That's his view. He finds it fascinating that people often consider AI as magical when, fundamentally, the underlying data management and security principles remain consistent. It's still data. It still needs protection.
And this isn't the first time they've tried this prioritization.
No, it's actually the second attempt. A previous effort to prioritize AI tools back in June 2024 was canceled because an executive order got rescinded. The deeper insight here, the repeated efforts underscore both the immense pressure to get AI into government operations and the significant challenges in doing that securely and at scale. It signals an urgency that's forcing a reevaluation of those traditional, sometimes slow certification timelines.
Okay, moving from AI prioritization to something maybe more fundamental for security, Software Bill of Materials, or SBOMs. CISA just released its new draft 2025 SBOM Minimum Elements Guide. I like the analogy an SBOM is like a list of ingredients for software. Really captures it.
That analogy is absolutely perfect. Okay. Truly captures the essence of SBOMs. They are a key software security tool, absolutely crucial for addressing supply chain risks, especially after things like the Log4j vulnerability really highlighted the cascading impact of hidden dependencies across the whole digital ecosystem.
Right, where one small piece causes huge problems.
Exactly. Yeah. Since the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA, released its first guide back in 2021, we've seen significant evolution. SBOM adoption is up. The tooling is better. Agencies like the Army are setting new requirements. Sectors like healthcare are increasingly integrating them into their security practices. Why? To understand what software components they're actually relying on.
Bringing transparency to the software supply chain.
That's it. Much needed transparency. The deeper insight here is that an SBOM isn't just, you know, another compliance document to check off. It's a foundational piece of intelligence. It allows for proactive risk management rather than just reactive patching after something bad happens.
So what's specifically new or updated in CISA's latest guidance? What should organizations be looking for in this refined approach?
Well, the updated guidance refines things like the data fields, the practices, the processes for using SBOMs. It reflects the growing maturity in the field, lessons learned from early adoption. It also proposes areas for further consideration, things like how do you effectively apply SBOMs to software as a service, SaaS offerings. That's tricky. Or how do you correlate SBOMs with security advisories for more proactive threat intelligence?
Yeah, making them more actionable.
Exactly. Hmm. Julie Davila, she's GitLab's VP of Product Security, makes a crucial point. Simply producing SBOMs lays the ground level for improved security. It's not just about having the list. It's about transforming that raw data into actionable insights about risks to drive better, more informed security decisions.
So the analysis is key.
Right. As the guidance clearly states, an SBOM alone is data about software components. Analysis of SBOMs transform data into insights about associated risks. So it's the analysis, not just the list itself, that truly empowers security teams, turning information into intelligence.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, now let's explore how AI can actually accelerate defense acquisition, bridging that notorious technology gap where, you know, our adversaries are often faster, more agile than the DoD's average. What was it, the 11-year acquisition cycle?
Yeah, that 11-year average is a sobering number. Mm-hmm. And this connection between AI and procurement, it sounds incredibly promising, doesn't it?
It really does. How can AI help fix that?
Well, this is a core challenge for national security, right?
Yep.
And AI is really seen as a long-awaited, maybe essential solution. The July 2025 AI Action Plan and Executive Order 14179, they explicitly identify AI as a transformative technology for both warfighting capabilities and for significantly improving those back-office operations within DoD, like acquisition.
Have we seen results yet?
We've already seen some incredibly promising early pilot successes, like the Defense Innovation Unit, DIU. They reduced AI-assisted compliance review times from 6 months down to just 3 weeks.
6 months to 3 weeks, that's dramatic.
It's huge. If we connect this to the bigger picture of national security, accelerating acquisition through AI is absolutely critical to maintain a competitive edge, ensure our forces have the most advanced capabilities faster than our adversaries can field theirs. It's a race.
So where specifically can AI provide the most immediate, the most impactful help with those key bottlenecks in the current process, like those incredibly complex compliance documents exceeding 1,000 pages sometimes, or exhaustive market research across multiple disparate systems?
Those are precisely the pain points where AI shines brightest. Compliance documentation, with its dense layers of rules, regs from DOD, the CDAO, the Air Force, it's a massive data processing challenge. AI, particularly something called small language models, SLMs, they can condense these 1,000-page monsters into actionable insights, saving acquisition pros months of painstaking parsing.
And market research.
Same thing. Market research currently requires sifting through the federal procurement data system, various service-specific databases, just trying to prevent duplication or find suitable alternatives. It's a perfect application for AI's pattern recognition capabilities. The Navy ran a pilot program, for instance, used AI to identify $12 million in potential savings just by flagging redundant software purchases.
$12 million? That's real money.
Tangible, significant gains. Absolutely.
Okay, you mentioned small language models, SLMs. How do they work? What makes them particularly effective for defense acquisition compared to the bigger general purpose LLMs we hear about, like from OpenAI or Google?
Right. SLMs are basically customized compact versions of those large language models. Think of them as highly specialized laser-focused intelligence agents rather than, you know, general purpose encyclopedias that know a little about everything.
So specialized for defense.
Exactly. Their advantage in defense acquisition is multifaceted. First, superior security. They can be trained and run on air-gapped classified networks.
Meaning completely isolated.
Physically isolated from unclassified external networks, guaranteeing the highest level of security for sensitive information. They're also specifically fine-tuned for defense terminology, defense requirements. This makes them highly effective for tasks like document summarization, identifying patterns to prevent duplication, like in that Navy pilot detecting anomalies in contract terms or pricing.
Finding outliers.
Finding outliers, yeah. And even helping in long-term planning.
Yeah.
Analyzing research and data to maybe spot future capability gaps 5-10 years down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Their precision and their security make them ideal for these sensitive domain-specific tasks.
When we talk about deploying AI in such a sensitive area like defense acquisition, the stakes are incredibly high. Security and accountability must be absolutely paramount. How is DoD addressing those critical concerns?
They are paramount concerns, absolutely. And the DoD's approach is firmly rooted in a human-in-the-loop model. Very important. Meaning AI serves strictly as a decision support tool, not a decision maker. The acquisition professionals, the humans, they retain full authority over all procurement decisions. AI provides analysis, summaries, recommendations, but humans rigorously validate and approve everything.
And the security of the models themselves.
For security, as we discussed, SLMs are deployed on those air-gapped networks for classified data, ensuring sensitive information never leaves DoD-controlled infrastructure. And furthermore, the establishment of AI governance boards is critical.
Who sits on those boards?
They comprise acquisition professionals, technologists, legal advisors, mission owners, a mix of expertise. They oversee model performance, ensure ethical use, prevent bias, manage resource allocation, with initial investments looking like $205 million per major command to get started. This ensures robust oversight, responsible integration.
So AI helps, but humans decide.
That's the principle. The deeper insight here is that while AI offers incredible speed, the DoD is acutely aware that trust and accountability, well, they cannot be outsourced to an algorithm. Especially when national security is at stake, it's a careful dance between automation and human judgment.
Okay, now for a really serious cybersecurity concern. This one goes right to the heart of individual privacy. A whistleblower warning from the Social Security Administration, SSA, about the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, and its alleged access to incredibly sensitive personal data.
This is an alarming and profoundly concerning situation. Charles Borges, he's the SSA's chief data officer, has come forward with a whistleblower disclosure, alleging that DOGE officials created a live, cloud-based version of SSA's entire data set.
The entire data set.
The entire data set containing personal information for over 300 million Americans. Allegedly uploaded to a vulnerable system without adequate security, without proper oversight. The Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, PEER, they describe this as a dangerous power grab, highlighting the significant risks involved.
Let's underscore the gravity here. What exactly is the nature of the data at risk? And what are the potential consequences if this data were compromised?
We're talking about extremely sensitive personal information. Your name, location, date of birth, citizenship status, race, ethnicity, phone numbers, mailing addresses, even your parents' social security numbers.
Everything.
Pretty much everything you wouldn't want out there. The whistleblower report warns of catastrophic potential. Widespread identity theft, individuals potentially losing vital health care and food benefits, and the government potentially being responsible for reissuing every American a new Social Security number if bad actors gain access.
That's almost unthinkable. What does SSA say?
SSA, for its part, stated it was not aware of any data compromises. They insist their data is stored in secure, walled-off environments. But the allegations themselves, they raise incredibly serious questions about data handling and oversight.
Can you walk us through the timeline here? It sounds contentious. How did DOGE get this level of access? What were the judicial implications?
Certainly. It has been contentious. DOGE initially pushed for access to SSA data back in January. A lawsuit was filed in March, which led to a temporary court block, stopping DOGE, for a time, from accessing the data.
But that didn't last.
No. The Supreme Court ultimately sided with the Trump administration in June, allowing DOGE to continue accessing the data. Now, the whistleblower alleges that even after that temporary restraining order was issued, DOGE officials circumvented court orders, approved high-risk activities outside of SSA's standard review procedures.
Going around the system.
Allegedly, yes.
Yeah.
With senior career officials at SSA apparently receiving instructions to undo the court-ordered access restrictions for DOGE employees within 24 hours. Tim Whitehouse from PEER stated pretty strongly that past efforts to keep this information safe are, quote, all out the window now, as Congress and the courts have acquiesced to this dangerous power grab.
So what's the deeper insight here?
Well, beyond the immediate terrifying security risks, this situation highlights a fundamental tension. A tension between the drive for government efficiency, which DOGE represents, and the inherent need for robust data stewardship, for individual privacy protection. It could set a potentially risky precedent for cross-agency data sharing. It really questions how extensively and how securely different parts of the government can access and utilize citizens' most private information without explicit preemptive safeguards built in first.
Let's shift our focus now to federal workforce challenges, starting with the State Department. Their recent reduction in force, the RAF, it impacted over 13,350 employees. That's about 15% of its total workforce, a significant cut.
It is a very significant cut. And this RAF created a truly perplexing, almost contradictory situation. According to the American Foreign Service Association, AFSA.
The union.
Right. They reported that at least 10 laid-off Foreign Service officers were simultaneously included on a promotion list. AFSA President John Dinkelman called this a situation that, quote, defies logic.
Promoted and laid off at the same time? Yeah. How does that happen?
Well, the department had claimed these RAFs were personnel agnostic, focused on eliminating redundant positions, not on individual merit. But these promotions directly contradict that narrative, right? These individuals were deemed meritorious enough for advancement, yet they lost their jobs anyway.
What does that do to morale?
The deeper implication here is the profound breakdown of trust. The chilling message it sends to the entire workforce about their career prospects, their value. It could potentially impact morale and future recruitment efforts for years to come. It's really damaging.
That is a chilling message. Dinkelman's statement that these individuals merited a promotion, which they will never get, really highlights the human cost here. How did the department arrive at this paradox? What was the mechanism?
Absolutely. The human cost is immense. The department's approach contributed to this paradox, partly by creating extremely narrowly defined competitive areas.
What does that mean?
It means they broke down the workforce into tiny groups for competition during the RAF. Over 700 for civil service, 800 for foreign service. This strategy effectively increased the likelihood of RAFs hitting specific offices, regardless of the individual performance or broader skills of the people within them. It limited the pool of employees who could compete to keep their jobs.
So good people could lose out just based on their office structure.
Exactly. And furthermore, the department unilaterally changed a 50-year RAF agreement they had with ASA this summer. Just changed it.
And this is happening in a specific context?
Yes, within a broader context where ASA is no longer recognized as a traditional union, following the Trump executive order back in March that eliminated collective bargaining rights for over half the federal workforce.
Yep.
An appeals court did allow the administration to proceed with that in May. So you have this combination: narrow competitive areas, unilateral agreement changes, weakened union protections.
Mm-hmm.
It's created significant instability and mistrust within the State Department's ranks.
So the deeper insight.
The deeper insight is how these seemingly bureaucratic policy decisions can profoundly undermine established civil service protections. And by extension, the perceived stability and attractiveness of federal careers themselves. It shakes the foundation.
Okay, let's turn to another federal workforce challenge, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA. Their plan to eliminate 30,000 jobs through attrition. What stands out to you here regarding the strong pushback from National Nurses United, other federal unions?
What immediately stands out, really leaps out, is the union's central, emphatic concern. The fear of privatization of veteran care. That's the core issue for them.
How does attrition lead to privatization?
They argue that staff cuts, even through attrition, meaning simply not replacing employees who leave or retire, will inevitably reduce the services the VA can provide internally. This, they fear, will then force more veterans into that fragmented, often more expensive, and potentially inferior private community care system.
So it's a slow squeeze.
That's the argument. Irma Westmoreland, she's chair of National Nurses United's VA division, clearly articulates it. Cutting staff reduces services, making it, in her view, a deliberate effort to cripple the VA and push care out into the private sector. The deeper implication: this isn't just a staffing numbers game. It's an ideological battle over the very model of veteran healthcare delivery public system versus private market.
The VA, though, often frames community care differently, right? As a cost-saving mechanism, providing veterans with more choice, more flexibility. How do the unions and veterans themselves counter that argument?
They offer compelling counter-evidence and direct testimonials. At a recent town hall, a Vietnam-era veteran shared a really powerful personal story about his wife, also a veteran. She received poor private care, had to fight to get back into the VA for what he described as astronomically better care, especially for her dementia.
But the quality isn't always equivalent.
That's the core of the pushback. The unions highlight the creation of a two-tiered system, where the VA maintains rigorous quality indicators, comprehensive care coordination, specialized expertise, things that simply aren't required of outside community care providers under current rules. So veterans might be pushed into a system with less accountability, potentially lower quality of care, contradicting that choice narrative with a stark reality of varying standards.
And it's not just about general healthcare, is it? The VA provides unique, specialized care tailored to veterans' specific needs. Camaraderie, peer support, research-based treatment for things like TBI, burn pit injuries, PTSD stuff often not found easily in the private sector.
Precisely. The VA offers a holistic environment. It uniquely integrates that peer interaction, the specialized research-based treatments for combat-related trauma, and a deep institutional understanding of the unique psychological and physical challenges veterans face. That level of integrated specialized care, it's incredibly difficult, maybe impossible, to replicate consistently in the fragmented private sector.
And the unions are united on this.
Very much so. AFGE, MAGE, NEFI, CU, FSCME, they're unified in their effort to protest, to advocate for a fully funded VA, arguing the administration is essentially starving the VA of resources monetarily and in staffing.
And hiring is a challenge, too.
A critical practical challenge they face is the lengthy federal hiring process. It often stretches from 6 to 18 months. That makes it impossible to keep up with attrition, even before you factor in hiring freezes. The Augusta VA, for example, they've only hired a handful of nurses and physicians since April. Meanwhile, attrition continues, creating critical care gaps.
So the deeper insight is?
The deeper insight here is that without proactive hiring, without addressing that pipeline issue, these cuts aren't just numbers on a spreadsheet. They could lead to a genuine crisis in veteran services, eroding a foundational promise made to those who have served our country.
Okay, now for another significant workforce shift. this time amplifying the National Guard's presence through increased federal recruitment. The Trump administration is driving this initiative, includes a new online application portal specifically targeting individuals with law enforcement or other relevant backgrounds. What's the context for this expansion?
This initiative is directly linked to a new executive order dated August 25th. It establishes the DC Safe and Beautiful Task Force.
Okay. And its purpose?
This task force is directed to create a specialized National Guard unit, explicitly drawing from federal law enforcement agencies, designed for deployment whenever circumstances necessitate. The executive order also ensures a National Guard quick reaction force for rapid nationwide deployment.
So a federally controlled guard unit?
It's a very proactive and indeed quite centralized approach to the domestic deployment of military forces. Distinct from how the Guard is typically activated by state governors in response to state needs, the deeper implication here is a potential federalization of local public order maintenance, which, of course, raises significant constitutional and political debates about the role of federal forces in domestic affairs, especially when local authorities might not request them.
And we've already seen an initial deployment in D.C.
Yes, an initial deployment of 800 National Guard members to Washington, D.C. back in August. That number then rapidly rose to 2,200, and it drew significant criticism from Democrats, from D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. She called the deployment unprecedented, unnecessary, and unlawful, especially given what they cited as low crime rates in the city at the time.
And the plan is broader than D.C.
That's right. The administration's stated intent is to deploy this specialized unit, not just to D.C., but potentially to other cities where public safety and order has been lost, according to their language.
And this is happening alongside other hiring.
Yes. This National Guard expansion is happening amidst broader federal law enforcement hiring surges. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, for example, received an additional $165 billion from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, specifically for a massive law enforcement hiring push.
Any other examples?
ICE has even removed age restrictions. They now allow applicants as young as 18, and they're offering $50,000 signing bonuses. All while most other federal agencies remain under a general hiring freeze, capping new hires at just one for every four employees who leave.
So a big contrast in resources.
A striking contrast. The deeper insight here is the clear difference between the robust funding and recruitment for certain federal law enforcement and military adjacent roles versus the austerity measures applied to many other federal agencies and services. It reflects a very clear shift in federal priorities and resource allocation under this administration.
Let's pivot now to the digital experience. How citizens interact with government service delivery online. We have some pretty exciting news here. Airbnb co-founder Joe Gebbia has been tapped as the new chief design officer of the United States, tasked with overhauling federal websites. This sounds like a potentially significant leap into modernizing how government interacts digitally with citizens.
It's an incredibly ambitious mission, no doubt, for the newly created National Design Studio within the White House. Gebbia's directive breathed new life into the design of sites where people interface with their government and, quite aspirationally, makes services as satisfying to use as the Apple Store.
High bar. Does he have government experience?
His ties to the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, are notable. He apparently successfully led the launch of OPM's fully online retirement application system, a project that had been stuck for decades. So yes, some track record there.
What does this appointment signal?
It signals a very strong push for user-centric design within government services. A recognition that the experience of engaging with government digitally can be just as impactful as the service itself. The deeper insight, bringing top-tier private sector design talent into government isn't just about making things look prettier. It's about fundamentally rethinking processes from the user's perspective to drive efficiency, usability, and ultimately, trust.
And the current state of federal websites certainly suggests a dire need for an overhaul, right? We're talking about, what, over 26,000 federal websites?
An incredible number.
With only 6% mobile-friendly, and a staggering 45% not mobile friendly at all. Plus, the largest agencies are planning to eliminate over 330 redundant or outdated websites. That's a stark picture of digital neglect.
It absolutely is a stark picture. It highlights the significant digital divide between the private sector's user experience and many government services. The America by Design initiative, which draws inspiration from the Nixon administration's 1970s beautification project, the one that brought us NASA's iconic worm logo and the National Park branding.
Right, I remember that.
It aims to transform critical services, things like student loan payments, passport renewals, national park visits, tax filing, making them easier, more intuitive.
Like the passport renewal pilot.
Exactly. The State Department's successful online passport renewal platform, now handling half of all renewals, serves as a kind of blueprint for this digital transformation. The administration plans to actively attract private sector talent to fix these digital potholes, as they call them, and really elevate the entire digital government experience.
And AI plays a role here, too.
It does. SSA Commissioner Frank Bisignano aims to use AI to drive call wait times down to single digits, illustrating how technology is expected to enhance both that front-end user experience and the back-end efficiency, the deeper insight. This initiative is an acknowledgement that public trust in government can be significantly bolstered or eroded by the ease or difficulty of accessing its services, and that a seamless digital experience is becoming a core component of effective governance in the 21st century.
Okay, let's unpack this next major policy debate. The environmental protection agencies, the EPA's significant and pretty controversial move to repeal the endangerment finding. This has massive implications for climate policy, for regulation moving forward.
This is a truly foundational shift, foundational, with potentially far-reaching consequences. The 2009 endangerment finding, which itself followed the Supreme Court's landmark 2007 Massachusetts versus EPA ruling.
Right. That case was key.
Absolutely key. That finding concluded that greenhouse gas emissions endanger public health and welfare. Now, this was critical because it provided the legal basis for the EPA to regulate climate pollution under the Clean Air Act. Repealing it effectively removes that legal cornerstone, the one that has underpinned much of federal climate action for over a decade.
So it takes away EPA's authority to act on climate.
That's the core of it. The deeper implication is that this isn't just a rollback of a single regulation. It's a strategic attempt to dismantle the very legal authority that allows the EPA to address climate change under current law. It goes right to the foundation.
The EPA has offered a rationale for this repeal, of course, but Joseph Goffman of the Environmental Protection Network, he's also a former EPA assistant administrator. He sharply criticized it, called the arguments borderline nonsense and a tortured interpretation of the Clean Air Act. What are the core arguments EPA is making to justify this?
Well, the EPA's arguments, which Goffman points out, have largely been rejected by federal courts previously. They include the claim that regulating emissions from specific sources, like vehicle tailpipes, is ineffective because they represent such a small percentage of the global greenhouse gas inventory.
So because U.S. cars aren't the whole problem, EPA can't regulate them.
That's essentially the argument. From their perspective, this allegedly negates EPA's authority to make an endangerment finding in the first place. Goffman emphasizes that the Supreme Court explicitly rejected similar arguments 18 or 19 years ago in Mass v. EPA.
So it's not a new argument.
Not at all. He further describes the EPA's stance now as asserting that if they, the EPA, don't understand how to solve the entire global problem, then it's not a problem for them to address domestically under the Act, which he finds to be, well, a twisted interpretation of the Clean Air Act's mandate.
So the deeper insight?
The deeper insight here is that this really isn't a scientific or technical debate at its core. It's a strategic legal maneuver. Leveraging pre-existing arguments, ones that have been legally challenged and largely defeated in the past, to achieve a specific policy outcome, deregulation of greenhouse gases.
So if this repeal goes through, what are the immediate impacts, the cascading impacts we can expect? What does this mean for existing and future environmental regulations?
The immediate impact is a proposed repeal of the existing greenhouse gas emission standards for new cars and trucks, covering model years all the way from 2012 through 2032. If finalized, these standards, designed specifically to curb vehicle emissions, would simply cease to exist. Gone.
And it's part of a bigger pattern.
Yes. This action is part of what Goffman calls a family of siblings deregulation. Back in June, a similar proposal was made to repeal power plant CO2 emission standards, and we can likely expect analogous actions for methane emissions from the oil and gas sector. If these all go through, it represents a substantial systematic rollback of federal climate regulation across multiple critical sectors of the economy.
What are the broader consequences?
The deeper implication is that this could significantly impede the U.S.'s ability to meet any climate targets, national or international. It could potentially impact its international standing on climate action and trigger a whole cascade of environmental and economic consequences down the road. It's a major reversal.
What recourse do individuals, advocacy groups, what recourse do you have to respond to this proposed repeal, given its potentially massive implications?
The primary recourse right now, at this critical stage, is to actively participate in the public comment period. Comments on the proposal are due in September. The EPA website provides clear information on how and where to submit them. This is where the public can voice concerns, provide data, make their case.
And beyond public comments.
Beyond that, it becomes a political and legal issue. Advocates are strongly encouraged to contact their members of Congress, especially those on relevant committees. Now, the source material specifically mentions contacting Veterans Affairs committees in the Senate and the House, which is, well, an interesting and perhaps unusual detail for an environmental issue.
That is unusual.
It is, but it directly highlights the recommended avenues for advocacy mentioned in the source material we reviewed, suggesting the issue is perhaps being framed to appeal to diverse concerns or constituencies. The deeper insight. This represents a pivotal moment for public engagement. Sustained advocacy, both through formal channels like comments and through political pressure, will be essential in shaping the final outcome and potentially challenging the administration's actions in court later on.
Finally, let's dive into a truly striking legal battle. The Trump administration's lawsuit against Maryland's entire federal bench. That sounds extraordinary. Confrontational, even challenging judicial independence itself.
It absolutely was extraordinary. Unprecedented in its scope. U.S. District Judge Thomas Cullen, who interestingly is himself a Trump nominee, ultimately dismissed the lawsuit. He called it potentially calamitous for the separation of powers.
What was the underlying issue? Why sue the entire bench?
The underlying issue stemmed from an order by the chief judge in Maryland, George L. Russell III. He issued an order aimed at halting immediate deportations of migrants who were challenging their removals in court.
Trying to ensure they got their day in court.
Exactly. The order sought to preserve the court's jurisdiction, ensure due process, prevent these rapid removals before their cases could be properly heard and reviewed by the judiciary. The administration, however, saw this as an obstruction to its immigration enforcement policies.
So the executive branch sued the judicial branch.
In effect, yes. The deeper insight here is that this wasn't merely a procedural dispute over an order. It was a direct challenge by the executive branch against the judiciary's fundamental ability to exercise its checks and balances over executive action, particularly in the sensitive area of immigration.
And Judge Cullen's ruling was emphatic.
Very emphatic. He found that the administration lacked the legal authority to bring such a suit in the first place, and that the judges were, in fact, immune from this kind of direct legal action by the executive. He stated very clearly that the proper recourse for the administration, if they disagreed with Judge Russell's order, was an appeal through the normal channels, not a more confrontational lawsuit targeting an entire bench.
He really pushed back on the approach.
He delivered a very strong rebuke to the administration's actions, calling their attacks on the judiciary unprecedented and unfortunate. He emphasized, and this is a powerful quote, "One branch's alleged infringement on another's exclusive power does not license a constitutional free-for-all." Asserting the judiciary's co-equal role and the critical importance of respecting the separation of powers.
How did the White House frame it?
The White House viewed the lawsuit as necessary, seeing the judge's order as a direct assault on the president's ability to enforce immigration laws. But Judge Cullen made it clear. While tensions between branches are, you know, a hallmark of our system, the method of addressing those tensions must respect the rule of law and establish legal processes.
Is the legal battle over?
Not entirely. The Justice Department has since filed a notice of appeal, so this specific legal fight isn't finished. But Cullen's initial ruling powerfully underscored the protection of judicial independence, the deeper implication. Such a lawsuit really tests the fragility of institutional norms when branches clash at this level. It signals a willingness, perhaps, to use extraordinary legal maneuvers to assert executive authority, and raises questions about what that might mean for the future of American governance and that delicate balance of power.
So what does this all mean? We've taken a really deep dive today, haven't we, into the dynamic, often contentious world of federal operations. From that ambitious overhaul of acquisition regulations aiming for speed, simplicity, to the rapid integration of AI and the critical need for robust cybersecurity across government. We've seen a federal government grappling with efficiency, technological advancement, and sometimes fundamental principles.
We certainly have. And we've also unpacked significant challenges in workforce management. Those RIFs, the job cuts sparking intense debate, impacting thousands of lives, and that striking clash over judicial independence that really underscores the ongoing tension between the branches of government. It's a lot.
It is a lot.
Indeed. These diverse stories, they truly underscore that constant push and pull within our federal landscape. They show us how policies, how practices, whether they're intended for simplification or maybe for greater control or for efficiency, how they inevitably ripple across agencies, impacting everything from national security down to the daily lives of citizens like you and the very fabric of our democratic institutions.
Connecting the dots.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's about how the machinery of government adapts. Sometimes gracefully, sometimes, well, turbulently, to the demands of a constantly changing world. The stakes in each of these areas we discussed today couldn't be higher for the future of our federal operations and the services they provide to you.
That's a powerful thought to leave you with. In a world of constant change, the ability to understand these intricate shifts in government isn't just about staying informed, is it? It's about recognizing how deeply intertwined these decisions are with our collective future and how they shape the world you actually live in. What aspects of today's deep dive resonated most with you? What will you be watching next as these stories continue to unfold? Thank you for joining us for this deep dive, and a huge thank you to Morgan Johnson for expertly guiding us through these complex issues.
My pleasure. Always good to talk through these things.
Until next time, stay informed and keep digging deeper.